Welcome to The Parrot Unbound. This is Grace, the podcast editor here at Portsmouth Public Library. You're listening to Blanket Fort Broadcasts, a series of discussions recorded in our homes during quarantine. This episode is the first half of Andrew, Catherine, Laura, and Polina's conversation about books that changed their lives. Hi, Lulu. Yeah, we're recording right now. It's very exciting. Don't mind my cat. Working from home is fun. The sacred podcast editor's oath obliges me to warn you that there are going to be some spoilers starting at the 6-minute and 40-second mark. If you don't want the second and third books in Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy ruined, please skip ahead to the 9-minute mark. And those books would be The Subtle Knife and The Amber Spyglass. 6 minutes and 40 seconds to 9 minutes, that is the spoiler zone. What? And the second round of Life-Changing Reads will be out in about a week, so stay tuned. From all of us at Portsmouth Public Library, stay safe and happy reading.
Hi everyone, this is Laura. I'm the Public Programming and Community Relations Librarian at Portsmouth Public Library. And with me today are Catherine, our Youth Services Librarian, Andrew, also from Youth Services, and Polina, who's in our Reference and Special Collections departments. Welcome everybody. Today we're gonna be talking about books that changed our lives. So I don't have any thoughts about what order to go in. We could start with kids' books and work our way up if we want to.
Well, I think that starting with kids' books is a great idea. I know one that really jumped out at me that kind of set me on the path of like creative writing and magic in general was Brian Jacques's Redwall series. I think there's like 30 of them or something, 30 volumes. And what I really liked when I was a kid was it was such a simple like fantasy adventure, but there was still like danger involved. And I just remember really enjoying feasts that he described. I thought that he did an excellent job at that. And I remember, I think I was in third or fourth grade when I started trying to write creatively. And it was because of that series. I felt like I could do it because of that. Because I was like, wow, I love animals and fantasy. I can do this. So that one really jumped out at me.
Did your writing have a lot of like elderberry liqueur and blackberry cordials and stuff in it?
It totally did. I described like rosemary bread before I even knew what rosemary was. I was like, I don't know what this is. I think my mom has a friend named Rosemary, but whatever. But it was just like super fun. And like my process when I was that young for creative writing was kind of parrot what I was reading. So I would almost like write whole scenes, but it was an exercise in kind of figuring out how to write, you know, build a story, which was super helpful.
Early fan fiction.
Yeah, exactly. Similarly, Lloyd Alexander's The Black Cauldron. I brought the one with the best cover, in my opinion.
Ooh.
So the Chronicles of Prydain is the name of the series, and this volume is called The Castle of Lear. And the cover I love so much because it almost looks kind of like stained glass sort of art. Not Art Deco, but Art Nouveau style. I remember the characters in it. It's a princess in the foreground with like bright red hair, which I loved when I was a kid because my brother had red hair. So I was always like, look, it's another ginger. This is great. But they both have like ornate, beautiful medieval gowns on. And the older enchantress has silver plated hair. And then the younger princess has like a circlet of silver with a moon on the top. And I always really liked this version of it. The princess, Eowyn, was my favorite character as well, because I always gravitated towards beautiful, mysterious, like, girls, because I think that, truthfully, I saw myself more in them than I saw in, like, a boy trying to learn how to be on the soccer team. Even though that's a valid experience for a lot of other people, I think that I was just interested in reading about prettiness and kind of like overcoming being something that you weren't necessarily supposed to according to your peers. I always gravitated towards stories like that. Did anybody else read that series?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
I didn't read either of those series.
They're both really good. You would probably really like Redwall, Polina. It has... In fact, I had a boyfriend who, until his adult life, thought that badgers were human-sized. based on that book, because badgers are really large in that book compared to mice.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, compared to mice, badgers are basically human sized, but still.
Yeah. It was actually, I remember one of my best friends moved away when I was really young, and we would send each other letters and we would pretend to be the badgers in the Redwall series. So she'd sign her letters like Lady of the Rose or something. I don't remember the character's name specifically. I would do mine as Lord Byron, because that was one of the badgers that was big.
From Mount Salamandastron.
Yes, exactly.
Still remember that for some reason.
Yep. So
I think cookbook, isn't there? I mm-hmm. think there's Is yeah, there? There's so many recipes in the series, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Made a cookbook.
Anybody else have kids' books on their list?
I feel like I have to mention Harry Potter more just because of the experience of it as opposed to the book. So I feel like since I was growing up in like the late 90s, early 2000s, when it was the most popular, it was just a really cool experience to be part of this like global phenomenon. And it was the first time I was really like part of a fandom or like was experiencing that. And speaking of fan fiction, I definitely a lot of Harry Potter fan fiction with my friends.
This could be a whole other podcast episode where we read our own fan fiction.
Oh no, I don't think I've volunteered. yeah, I think that was just a big part of my childhood.
Definitely me too. Going to like the midnight book releases was the most special.
And then staying up all night reading it.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I had a nightlight in my room because I was scared of the dark, but it was really just because it was so bright that I could read literally all night. And my mom would always like sneak by and open. The night that like the 6th and the 7th books were released, I read them the whole night and lighted it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So it's interesting you're saying, Catherine, the reason that those books changed your life is almost that they gave you a sense of how literature could connect you to other people, and that it was such a big phenomenon. There were so many people around the world reading it at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely enjoyed the story, but it was more just being part of something so big and knowing that there was people everywhere who were having the same experience with me. I just thought that was really cool.
That's really interesting. My only sort of youth book, which definitely veers into teen, I picked His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, which to this day is my favorite series. The reason that it changed my life is a spoiler, because it's from the end. So does anybody object to this? And if someone's listening, they can just skip forward a minute. Okay. There is a part in His Dark Materials where they go to the underworld, and then they kind of travel through the underworld and come out the other side. And there's this evocation of what happens after you die that I knew reading it was fictional, but I wasn't raised in a particular religious belief, so I didn't have any sense of what happened after I die. And I realized as I was making this list that I'd still retained that idea as part of my sense of things. And so basically, there's sort of a shade of yourself or your soul or something left in the underworld. And what the hero and the heroine do is they create a way for people's spirits to be released almost and kind of join back in with all of creation. So you get this amazing image of people coming out a window on the other side of the underworld and like dissolving back into the world, whether it's their consciousness or their actual matter, becoming part of the world again. And that definitely like blew my mind and is with me to this day, I would say.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with that series. I actually accidentally ordered The Subtle Knife from a Scholastic book drive first and read that. And I believe I was in 7th grade when I did that. And the way that Philip Pullman talked about like death, and specifically the way that he created that almost shadow world where people who are, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Laura, but I believe there was an element of like people who were dead and they would go after adults and try to make them like them. Do you remember that part? They were traveling in a hot air balloon over a landscape and they watched like adults being taken by these like creatures.
Yes, specters.
Yes.
Yeah. And
that part always stuck with me. It was like really scary when I was a kid because the protagonists are teenagers and like children couldn't see these specters, but teenagers started being able to see them.
And yeah, it was just on the verge of puberty that it becomes susceptible to it.
Yeah, and it like kind of goes along with like Philip Pullman's Daemon creation as well. He had a lot of things in there about like growing up that the soul manifested physically as a daemon. It changed a lot when you were a kid, but by the time you were an older teenager, your daemon like landed on a certain animal. And I always thought that story kind of drove home the idea of growing up, the idea that you become less able to change and less able to change your life when you're older than when you're a kid. And that always stuck with me.
Yeah, I agree. And I think he, part of it, I think, is a positive evocation of growing up as well, which I know that he wrote in answer to some of that children's literature that's all about the sort of evils of growing up, like Peter Pan, or in particular, C.S. Lewis and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There's that book where Susan like discovers boys in lipstick, and that's the end for her. You know, so he was trying to, I think, write something in answer to that, which also is kind of important when you're at that age to hear that positive evocation of what happens for you becoming an adult.
It's a nice counterbalance to those stories too, because like as someone who works with children and books, there's so many of those stories that kind of demonize adulthood.
What were the YA books that you wanted to share, Polina?
Well, I read all of like the girl friendship books. So all of the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants books and the Georgia Nicholson books, which, have you guys read those? They're this British girl. It's just like laden with insane teen slang that she and her...
Oh, friend, Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging.
Yes. And Knocked Out by My Nunga Nungas. And the first time I read one of those books, I was sitting in Barnes & Noble and I had never read anything like that before. I didn't know books could be that like absurd and realistic. And I was laughing out loud being stared at. And I was like, this is it. I'm reading this. There are a lot about boys, but so much about friendships and how to be a person and how to grow up. Because all of these, like the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants books, go from when they're 14 all the way up through when they are... There's like a final one that isn't really part of them that came out a few years ago, maybe like 7 or 8 years ago. And they're like in their 30s, late 20s, and having kids. It's nice to go through that whole journey with them. And more than any of those, I like the Ruby Oliver books, which have titles like The Boyfriend List and The Boy Book. So I never wanted to tell anyone that I read them. but I would reread them at home all the time. She has like these intense friend breakups and makes these new friends. And they're also obviously centered around romantic relationships as well. Following Ruby and how she grows from like 14, 15 to 18 years old when she's graduating from high school, and how she like actively tries to make new friends when her like core friend group absolutely devolves. It was really important to be able to read that when I had switched schools and went to a different school in like 6th and 7th and 8th grade, learning that you have to actively try and make friends and do things, and it's okay to grow and be better. Oh man, I've read the Ruby Oliver books so many times. I could talk about them for ages. I tell people to read them all the time.
That's interesting, because I was thinking about that when I was making my list, that the marker of a book that changed my life was partly that this is the book that I keep buying for other people or keep giving away to other people and having to rebuy for myself. Or immediately at the library, we do this all the time, but you bring back a book and you're like, I know so-and-so will like this, and you just check it out to them and leave it on the shelf for them, that kind of thing. So yeah, I get that.
When I was a young teen, I gifted all my friends Georgia Nicholson books, the Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging, for their birthdays. And we have like a family friend who, when she turned 13, I gave her the first 3 books because I was like, you should read these and have them. These go be ridiculous.
I really liked what you said about how there are books that you fell in love with and you loved reading, but had titles that made you embarrassed to like tell other people about, because I can definitely relate to that. One of the books that I was so thankful for when I was a teenager was The Geography Club by Bren Hartinger. And it was about this boy who was struggling with whether he was gay or not. He like wasn't sure at first. And then he's like, okay, I'm definitely gay, but like, what can I do about this? he wanted to start like a gay straight alliance in his school. And for context, this came out in like 2002. So it was like kind of still rare for those. And it was still a little scary to be like gay in America. And he started a club for it, but he called it the Geography Club because he didn't want anyone to know what he was meeting with his friends about. But he also wanted a place to explore that. And it resonated so much with me. I did come out early, but I was still nervous about adults knowing that I was gay and like just putting it out there. So it was one of the books that I had. Another one was Weetsy Bat by Francesca Leah Block.
Oh, I love Weetsy Bat.
That series actually was formative for me, not just because it had like queer characters, but it also had some of the strongest female characters I read. It had some of the most lyrical prose that I'd ever read. Just a gorgeous book to read, but it also involved queer people. And it actually was written, I think, in the early 90s. So it was a snapshot of life for gay people almost before my time too, which I found extremely interesting and valuable. Like, a lot of people died of AIDS in the 80s and the 90s. Queer people weren't really creating a lot of accounts of life. And Francesca isn't queer, but she grew up in LA and she had gay friends and she saw what they were going through. And between the Geography Club and Weetsy Bat, I feel like that was the basis of my queer education. And it was a great place to start from. I was also thankful that it wasn't titles like Boy Meets Boy, or like, I think the two titles that were available at Borders at the time was like Boy Meets Boy and The Joys of Gay Sex. And I was not going to buy that when I was in high school from someone I didn't know at a bookstore. I just was not there for it. So those were like really valuable resources for me.
Catherine, did you have any books like that sort of helped you connect to your identity almost?
I think for me, talking about sort of hiding books, I grew up in a very strict household. So I just remember like the first time I was allowed to go into the young adult section of the library, and it was like magical. So in my library growing up, the children's room was in the basement and then the young adult was actually upstairs. So I could check books out and then hide them and bring them home. And I can't really think of one that, well, I can, and it's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which is sort of a young adult book, sort of an adult book. I could talk about that all day, so I need to not.
I loved A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. I read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn in maybe sixth grade, and I reread it and reread it and reread it.
Yeah, I did the same thing, actually, because my fifth grade teacher gave me her personal copy to borrow when I was 11, the same age as the main character, and a lot of the stuff, like, definitely went over my head. Then I reread it again in middle school and in high school and in college, and I've reread it many times as an adult. That was the first book I remember specifically thinking about, like, gender roles and how women are treated, because it's not something we really talked about at home. And I think there's a lot of instances of that in the book. And it was sort of like an introduction to feminism before I knew what feminism was. I mean, it's set in the 1900s, so women were treated very differently anyway, but and in a lot of ways, Francie is just sort of like complacent, but she's also a very strong character and she overcomes challenges. So in that way, it was super impactful to me. And I related to her a lot because she's very quiet and doesn't like to make waves, but she still is able to achieve everything she wants to do. Like, that doesn't make her less strong because she's quiet.
Along those same lines, you're making me think about another one on my list, which is the Neapolitan novels by Elena Ferrante, which I think are very different, but in particular, they helped me connect with like a nuanced sense of female friendship. Have any of you read those? Like My Brilliant Friend? Oh my gosh, you have to.
I've checked out that first book on audiobook or from Overdrive many times, and or like I've put myself on the holds list but never gotten to it in time.
It is available on Overdrive on audiobook, to mention. There aren't a lot of really good books about female friendship, and there are a lot more now than there used to be, but that was probably one of the first that I read that really evoked my experience of female friendship, and particularly a friendship that lasts from early childhood into late adulthood. So it goes from, I think, when they're really small children all the way through to their 60s and all of the ups and downs that they both experience and the way that their paths sort of diverge. It's just a really interesting look at how shared history can affect your friendship. And in particular, the thing that I really loved about it, it was probably one of the first series that I read that really did this, is the way that Elena Ferrante writes someone thinking two conflicting thoughts at the same time is really powerful. And I haven't read a lot of writers who are good at doing that. Another one that I really love is E.M. Forster. But there's so many moments in the Neapolitan novels where Lenu, the main character, is like desperately loving and hating somebody at the same time, or like feeling absolute disgust and like a complete longing for their approval at the same time. I mean, she's just so conflicted all the time, which is my experience of life. And that I think I hadn't read in very many places. So that was a pretty powerful series for me.
Well, I think that's like one of the weirdest lessons that I've learned as an adult, is that friendships aren't static. The same person you had a relationship with 10 years ago, your relationship could be dramatically different to them, even if you still talk every day or every week. I have people who I never thought they'd be what they are now in my life from where we started.
And on that note, we're going to close out this part of Books That Changed Our Lives. The second half of the conversation should be out in about a week, so stay tuned. And happy reading.